Good morning, and welcome to the Thursday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Meet the woman who invented fidget spinners, the newest toy craze sweeping America, by Jennifer Kalfas. Catherine Hettinger has an inventor's mind. When she notices a problem, she tries to imagine a toy or device that can remedy it. So, when she saw young boys throwing rocks at police officers and people walking past them while visiting her sister in Israel, her wheels started turning. She started brainstorming devices that could distract young children and provide them with a soothing toy to play with. First, she thought of a soft rock that kids could throw. But then she tossed that idea aside, still thinking about other options when she returned to her home in Orlando, Florida. It was there that she eventually developed the idea that would become the original fidget spinner, more than two decades before the wildly popular device became the must-have toy for both kids and adults this year. It started as a way of promoting peace, and then I went on to find something that was very calming, Hettinger, now in her 60s, told Money of the fidget spinners, which she first began imagining back in the 1980s. The toys now come in different designs and have hit the mass market after the patent expired on Hettinger's original product earlier this year, meaning companies can sell the product independently from her. But Hettinger isn't upset about the sudden popularity and capitalization of her invention. In fact, she's excited about it. Maybe if it was some kind of exploitive product, like a new style of cigarettes, and my only motivation was to make money, I'd have a different attitude, Hettinger said. But I am just thrilled. The modern iterations of the devices, made out of metal or plastic, and have a bearing in the middle that allows it to be spun. Some of the products have prongs on them, while others are circular. The spinners, which range in price from just a few dollars to hundreds, are intended to calm nerves and help people with stress and anxiety. The handheld gadgets are now so popular that different versions of fidget spinners make up all of Amazon's top 20 bestsellers for toys and games as of May 2nd. When you start seeing these things flying off the shelf at your local 7-Eleven, you know things are heating up, Hettinger joked. Hettinger grew up in Oklahoma and attended Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, a college known for its engineering and technology programs, before moving to Florida. The first fidget spinner debuted in 1993 and her patent approved 4 years later. But they didn't take off. Instead, she made rounds at fairs selling a couple thousand devices and frequently tried selling them to toy companies. Once she had her patent, she booked a meeting with Hasbro, the third largest toy maker in the world, and even found herself using the fidget spinner to ease her nerves before the meeting with the company's vice president. That was one good thing about this product. If I walked into their headquarters spinning it, it totally calmed me down, she recalled. It's not an easy thing for most people to walk in and close big deals. Hasbro didn't pick up the spinners, sending her a rejection letter after testing it on consumers. But now Hasbro sells the fidget spinners, almost 20 years after it denied the original product. So why the sudden boom in popularity? Hettinger isn't sure, but she speculates as a result of the recession in 2008, people may be looking for ways to calm their nerves and have fun. That was always the concept, to help people, she said. I experienced it for myself. There's a real need for this, she added. And given the device's sudden popularity, Hettinger is working on a way to sell her original spinners, which have not been on the market throughout the current craze. Soon she's going to launch a Kickstarter called the Classic Spinner and sell her version online. While she's excited about the spinner's newfound popularity, she's still got an inventor's mind and continues to observe her surroundings and think up products that can help make life easier for people. Her latest project is a diet and fitness application for iPhones that she's working on with the help of the Inventors Council of Central Florida, a Florida-based group that she's a member of that works on new ideas together. The culture we live in now, the times now, everyone has a need for fun. People are realizing it, and it's true, she said. The only limits are the ones you place on yourself. Meet the first U.S. amputee to scale Mount Everest by Melissa Chan. Gasping for air in the middle of the night during one of the worst moments on his trek to the perilous peak of Mount Everest, Jeff Glassbrenner thought of his dad. The Wisconsin native was summoning his strength after being jolted awake by a sudden inability to breathe more than 17,000 feet in the air. In that instant, he questioned why he had left his family behind in Colorado to take the life-threatening journey. Then he recalled his late father's words of wisdom. "When I was 12, my dad told me I can choose to be pitiful or I can choose to be powerful, but I can't be both," Glassbrenner, now 44, told Time in a recent interview. "That's what came to my head." Glassbrenner chose power over pity and became the first American amputee to scale the world's tallest mountain in an expedition featured in the new virtual reality documentary Capturing Everest. "The feat last spring was nearly a lifetime in the making," said Glassbrenner, who lost his right leg in a farming accident in 1980 when he was 8. Glassbrenner was cutting hay on a tractor with his father when the vehicle struck a rock, a common occurrence during a typical day of doing chores with his dad. "I was always the shadow of my dad. Whatever he did, I tagged along and helped him out," he said. Glassbrenner removed the rock and was about to hop back on the tractor when his father turned the machine back on too soon. Glassbrenner's leg was sucked in. "It kind of took my leg off like a pencil sharpener. It was really fast. I remember looking down and seeing bone sticking out of my leg. 10 feet away, I could see my shoe with my foot still in it," he recalled. The boy, who loved swimming and running, was rushed to the hospital, where his heart stopped twice, where he had more than a dozen operations in 47 days, and where doctors told him he'd never swim and run again. "They handed me a sheet of paper that had a whole lot of limitations placed on it. At the top of that was sports," he said. "They confirmed my worst fears. It was a hard pill to swallow. Sadly, I believed all those limits." Glassbrenner's father never spoke candidly about the accident with his son, even in the final days before the elder Jeff Glassbrenner died of lung cancer in 2010. "He grew up in an era where you didn't talk about your feelings. Every time I'd bring it up, he would always change the subject," the mountaineer said. "The only time we ever spoke about it, he told me he was proud of me, and that's all I ever really needed. I've told him it was just an accident. It can happen to any of us at any time. I didn't hold it against him," he added. "That was my closure with that." A decade after the accident, Glassbrenner started playing sports again and quickly became a star. He discovered wheelchair basketball while attending the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater and went on to become a 3-time Paralympian and a 2-time world champion in the sport. The accident and the physical, emotional, and spiritual challenges that followed was the catalyst that ultimately inspired Glassbrenner to tackle Everest, he said. It caused him to become more competitive and pushed him to prove people wrong. "Most of the time in my life, I feel like I'm on top of the world, and I truly wanted to be there," said Glassbrenner, who is married with 2 young children. "Those doctors telling me I couldn't do things? Why can't I? I should never put limits on myself. I viewed that as the ultimate challenge in endurance and dealing with adversity and believing in yourself." During the 2-month trek last year, Glassbrenner lost 20 pounds, spent more than 5 hours trapped in a storm with 70-mile-per-hour winds, and suffered the breathing scare, which was caused by a condition called Shane-Stokes respiration. He did it all while using a prosthetic leg that was increasingly ill-fitting, stuffed with extra socks to make up for his lost weight. But Glassbrenner endured, and he reached the peak on his first attempt up the mountain. "I just really couldn't believe it. I trained for it. I imagined it. I visualized myself on the summit. But to be standing there was surreal," he said. "Dreams come with risks." Now Glassbrenner's journey can be experienced through Capturing Everest, the first virtual reality documentary of an expedition up Mount Everest, created by Sports Illustrated and Endemol Shine Beyond USA. Glassbrenner said he agreed to be part of the project to give his 11-year-old daughter, who has a seizure disorder, the ability to take the trip with him. She'll never have a chance to climb Mount Everest, but I know, being part of this project, she can come along on this journey with me. She can see Daddy climb. She can see every step I took along the way, he said. Next up, the motivational speaker is attempting to reach the North Pole and the South Pole and climb the seven summits. He's also competing on reality competition show American Ninja Warrior in Denver this month. I want people to understand that the only limits are the ones you place on yourself, he said. Don't listen to others when they say you can't do it. You have to believe in yourself. Glassbrenner still gets goosebumps every time he thinks about the view from the mountain's peak. He's now thankful for the accident, which turned his life around almost 40 years ago, but later helped him reach the top of the world. I'm a farm boy from Wisconsin. Without this accident, I don't know if I would have done that, he said. Everything happens for a reason. How the Republican health care bill changed since they last tried to pass it. By Sam Frizzell. After numerous amendments and 5 months of public debate, the Republican bill to repeal Obamacare is closer than ever to passing the House of Representatives. Officials said Wednesday night that the House would vote on the bill on Thursday. President Trump and House Speaker Paul Ryan can afford 23 defections in the Republican ranks if they want to pass a bill. Currently, there are about 18 to 20 members who oppose the bill, according to different counts. That's at least two fewer no's than yesterday, and more could come on board in the next day. Here's how the bill has changed over the past 5 weeks. The first draft of the Republican bill, hammered out in large part by Ryan and finalized at the end of March, made two major changes to Obamacare. First, the bill cut subsidies to low and middle income individuals. Instead of basing the subsidies on income, the bill based the subsidies on age. Most people who rely on Obamacare subsidies would have seen their subsidies dramatically reduced. Older people get more subsidies than younger, or up to $4,000 per individual. For example, a middle-aged couple in rural North Carolina receiving $10,600 under Obamacare would receive just $6,500 under the Republican replacement. Many would have been unable to afford their plans. It would have helped healthy and young people and disadvantaged sicker and older people. Second, the bill would phase out the expansion of Medicaid in states like Pennsylvania and Kentucky, which chose to raise the eligibility from the poverty line to 133% of the poverty line. That would cut off millions who had been covered by Medicaid for the first time. It also cut taxes on the wealthy. The top 0.1% would see around $200,000 more each year. It defunded Planned Parenthood, and it repealed the individual mandate in Obamacare. Many lawmakers, including significant numbers of Republicans, opposed the bill. It would have increased the number of uninsured people by 24 million in 2026, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. It would cause premiums to rise by an average of 15% to 20% in the short term, though they would eventually fall in the long term. It would reduce the deficit by just around $150 billion, a relatively small amount. This plan was strongly opposed by groups ranging from the American Medical Association to the American Association of Retired People, as well as conservative groups. Conservative Republicans said it didn't do enough to lower premiums and repeal regulations, and moderate Republicans said it would hurt too many people who had benefited from Medicaid and the Obamacare premiums. Republican leaders decided on March 31st not to bring the bill to the floor for a vote when it became clear it would fail. It seemed at the start of April that Republicans had defeated their own effort to repeal Obamacare. But during the April recess, a moderate Republican from New Jersey, Representative Tom MacArthur, hashed out an agreement with the arch-conservative House Freedom Caucus. The underlying bill would remain the same. In a new amendment, however, states would be allowed to opt out of a crucial Obamacare provision that protected people with pre-existing conditions from being charged higher prices. The so-called MacArthur Amendment said that insurance companies would still be required to cover people with pre-existing conditions, only now they could charge them higher premiums. Some healthier people might see their premiums fall, but those with pre-existing conditions, 52 million Americans are estimated to have a pre-existing condition, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, would likely see their premiums rise dramatically if they're buying insurance on the marketplace. In order to protect those with pre-existing conditions in states that opt out of the Obamacare rule, there would be a high-risk pool to help cover individuals backed up by federal funds. But the pools have a shoddy history. Most are underfunded and charge people as much as 200% more than they would pay on the open market. Nonetheless, in the last week of April, the MacArthur Amendment helped swing most of the near 40-member House Freedom Caucus to support the bill. Still, however, there were numerous moderate Republicans who opposed the bill. The MacArthur Amendment did not allay their underlying concerns. In fact, it pushed the bill farther to the right. The concern among moderates was that the bill would not adequately people those with pre-existing conditions. The high-risk pools did not seem to be a stable enough protection, many argued, and they would not receive enough funding. Representative Fred Upton, a moderate congressman from Michigan who had previously opposed the bill, visited the White House on Wednesday and announced the most recent amendment, $8 billion in federal funding to shore up the high-risk pools. That was enough to sway another member, Representative Billy Long of Missouri, and as of Wednesday afternoon, several moderates said they could reconsider the bill. Still, the $8 billion will likely not be enough to cover shortfalls in the high-risk pools. And all of what moderates disliked about the first version of the bill will remain in place. It's still the underlying policy, said Representative Ryan Costello, a moderate Republican who opposes the bill. Now, there is talk about a vote this week before the bill can get a score from the Congressional Budget Office, as is customary. The question is whether all the amendments were enough. Everything you need to know about the Google Docs email phishing scam by Eric Jenkins. An alarming phishing scam began spreading around the Internet Wednesday in an attempt to access Google accounts through an email embedded with a fake Google Docs file. This scam is more convincing than most. The email takes users who click on the file to a legitimate Google sign-in screen to grant permissions, so it's no surprise to see widespread reports of the hacking across social media platforms like Twitter. If you received the email or are concerned you might be targeted next, here's what you need to know. Who was affected by the Google Docs scam? The phishing appears to have been aimed at journalists at first. News began making its rounds across Twitter after Joe Bernstein, a reporter at BuzzFeed, tweeted, "I got a Google Doc invite from a BuzzFeed email address, clicked on it, and it spammed everyone I've ever emailed." Because the scam appears to target everyone in the victim's address book, it didn't take long before more reports from people outside of the media world began to flood in. PSA, if you get a someone shared a doc on Google Drive notification, don't open it, tweeted Peter Miller. It's a scam/hack that's going around the country. Warning, if you've accepted a Google Doc link recently from a friend and it goes to a broken link, change your password immediately, tweeted Sweet Maples. And from Anna the Navigator, guys, I was just bamboozled by the hashtag Google Doc hack. Please don't judge, just support me during my time of need. What happens if you open the Google phishing link? You don't want to find out by clicking yourself, but Zach Latta, a San Francisco-based hacker, tweeted a GIF that showcases the entire process. As the GIF shows, clicking on the file actually brings you to a real Google sign-in page, where it asks users to choose an account to continue. If you grant permissions to the link, the email spams every person in your contacts, and the cycle continues from there. We don't know what exactly happens after that, but it's definitely concerning that hackers have access to all of this contact information. The Google Docs email came from a Mailinator address. What's that? Mailinator is a type of disposable email address service that lets users access emails on the Mailinator site without having to sign up for an account. Any email name you can think of already exists at Mailinator.com, and you can use any of them, the official Mailinator site reads. Want Brian the Skink at Mailinator.com? You got it. Want Pretty Mothra, Scary Gavin? No problem. Those and any other mailboxes you think of at Mailinator.com are created when email arrives. One of the main advantages of using this service is that there's no connection to your real email address, making it difficult to track any email sent from a Mailinator back to you. What should I do if I open the Google Docs phishing email? As with any hacking case, you'll want to immediately change your passwords to secure any sensitive personal information. Google is working to restore order, according to a statement it released in this series of tweets. Official Google statement on phishing email. We have taken action to protect users against an email impersonating Google Docs and have disabled offending accounts. We've removed the fake pages, pushed updates through safe browsing, and our abuse team is working to prevent this kind of spoofing from happening again. We encourage users to report phishing emails in Gmail.
How realistic are Elon Musk's big ideas? We asked the experts. By Eric Jenkins. Elon Musk has big plans for the future. During a recent TED Talk, the 45-year-old executive revealed his vision and motivation for each of his companies, the Boring Company, Hyperloop, and Tesla. There's a lot Musk wants to accomplish in a short period of time, which begs the question, can he actually turn his futuristic plans into reality? Fortune spoke to several experts to see if they share the CEO's optimism. The Boring Company Tunnels. Musk established the Boring Company in December 2016 after he complained on Twitter about traffic driving him nuts. According to the company's recent concept video, the idea is to have Teslas, of course, pull up to a port stationed on the side of a busy city road where the cars are then submerged beneath the street. Once on the underground freeway, cars would be able to travel at speeds up to 124 miles per hour. While exciting, experts are unsure whether the proposal could actually be executed. The chances of this coming to fruition all comes down to cost, said Randall Gunsler, a professor at the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Georgia Tech, adding that Musk must consider the integration of this technology with planning policy. Who owns the roads? Who owns the tunnels? Who's responsible for the vehicles? Fred Movensada, professor of systems engineering and environmental engineering at MIT, compared the Boring Company to his work on a proposed underground high-speed train in the 1960s. The 1960 train's main problems were with deep tunneling and its guidance system, and what Musk is proposing is essentially a new version of that. Movensada said of the train, which engineers had hoped could run between Boston and Washington, D.C. within 1 hour, "At the time, we were talking 400 miles per hour with deep tunnels that could peel off and go to Hartford, for example, but we were always concerned with what would happen if the train got stuck. How would we evacuate the people from those depths in that air pressure?" Hyperloop train. Musk thinks it's possible to utilize the Hyperloop, his proposed above-ground rapid transit system that would propel passenger pods at airliner speeds, in the Boring Company's underground tunnels as well. "There's no real length limit," he said, adding that the Hyperloop's technology could be useful for routes between Washington, D.C. and New York City. Hebert Einstein, a professor at MIT's Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, doesn't necessarily disagree. "It's just not a new concept," he said. "If you look at the history of New York City tunnels, the idea of a subway that goes through partially low-pressure tubes is certainly doable. That concept is 100 years old," he said. But Gunsler has some questions. "You build deep tunnels, but now you have to reintegrate vehicles back above ground. You're not just building a tunnel, but a port interchange from a moving system underground to above-ground delivery," he said. Explaining that existing infrastructure like subways and highways on the surface must be accounted for. Autonomous cross-country travel. Musk said Tesla is still on track to develop fully autonomous cars capable of driving from New York to Los Angeles by the end of the year. This would mean a Tesla could go from a parking lot in California to a parking lot in New York without being touched at any point the CEO said. It's a tall order, and Tesla has just under 7 months to fulfill that promise. But Pablo Durango Cohen, an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University, says it's definitely possible. That's easy, he said. Uber already has fully autonomous vehicles in urban areas like Pittsburgh. Long-distance trips on interstate highways are easier than urban trips. All that is needed is some money to finance service infrastructure, if needed. Colbert's gay Trump joke went too far, by Daniel Daddario. What characterized Stephen Colbert's Late Show in its early going was its host's evident curiosity about the world and engagement with his guests. Even as the show struggled to find a consistent voice and to get a foothold in the ratings, Colbert, finally free from his Comedy Central-era faux persona as a conservative blowhard, seemed boundlessly engaged, from the personal struggles of figures in power to complicated issues of identity and politics. Colbert's inherent respect and courtliness had a way of working against him when it came to presidential politics, which he only fitfully was able to get a handle on, apologizing at one point to Donald Trump for jokes about him. He planned a mild, pleasant election night broadcast that, with the election of Trump, fell into compelling chaos. In retrospect, this helped change Colbert's fortunes by changing his tone. His show became competitive with fun, sunny Jimmy Fallon by adopting the NBC host's circus ringleader attitude to entertainment and then putting a grimy filter on it. Colbert's show was going to rise or fall not on the guests, indeed, some episodes have mixed new monologues with rerun guest interviews, but on him, a person who, after a long search for a persona, had stumbled upon angry and loud. Which brings us to Colbert's recent controversial monologue in which he directed a homophobic slur at the president, suggesting sarcastically that he engages in penetrative sex acts with Vladimir Putin. What's most striking about the monologue, which aired Monday night, is how remarkably unmotivated it feels. Notionally angry at Trump for having treated CBS's Face the Nation host John Dickerson unfairly, Colbert builds up a head of steam in an instant. It's just as ginned up as Fallon's enthusiasm for the lip-syncing abilities of every one of his guests. You're not the POTUS, you're the BLOTUS, Colbert intones, the umbrage in his voice rising. You're the glutton with the button. You're a regular Gorge Washington. It's not hard to see why Colbert ended up defaulting to a joke that presumes the worst thing you can call a man is gay. The rest of his material wouldn't get him booked as a guest on The Late Show. The show, like all late-night shows, is structured to privilege Colbert's sensibility and his wit above all. But Colbert has little to say beyond broad, bland puns about Trump's physique, intelligence, and relative popularity. There's no guiding point of view here as to what makes Trump so uniquely nettlesome as to make the outrage routine even plausible. Colbert seems simply to be working off a list of lowest common denominator critiques of Trump that anyone could understand, at least a few could be provoked by. That a fairly conventional sort of anti-gay humor comes as the culmination of a routine so allergic to ideas is no surprise. Finding a way to speak to a wide audience in language that's decipherable to all, in short, broadcasting, was always Colbert's task on CBS, and one he had greater than anticipated difficulty achieving. But those hosts who've been met with real artistic success in the Trump era, Seth Meyers, Samantha Bee, have been able and willing to introduce fact and argument to go beyond the argot of pure inarticulate anger that Trump himself has brought into the mainstream. Colbert's format demands a straight-up monologue into which he can't really introduce PowerPoint slides, but he's so assiduously stripped away everything beyond today's scandal and his rhyming dictionary that he's created a show worth blogging about, but not worth watching. The worst part is that one suspects Colbert knows the difference. In his election night broadcast, as a show that appeared planned around the predicted uneventful march toward a Clinton victory, Colbert delivered a startling and seemingly extemporaneous monologue about the things that unite Americans. That impulse, the same one that led him to apologize to Trump in 2015, has been for unity even when it doesn't quite fit. And in the months since that special and since that election night, Colbert has won by learning that nothing unites like rage, expressed poorly, but with passion.
AFT President Betsy DeVos and Donald Trump are dismantling public education.
by Randy Weingarten. Donald Trump may say teachers are important, but he spent his first 100 days undermining the schools most educators work in, America's public schools. One of President Trump's first acts was to appoint the most anti-public education person ever to lead the Department of Education. Betsy DeVos has called public schools a dead end and bankrolled a private school voucher measure in Michigan that the public defeated by a 2-to-1 ratio. When that failed, she spent millions electing legislators who then did her bidding, slashing public school budgets and spreading unaccountable for-profit charters across the state. The result? Nearly half of Michigan's charter schools rank in the bottom of U.S. schools, and Michigan dropped from 28th to 41st in reading and from 27th to 42nd in math compared with other states. Now, DeVos is spreading this agenda across the country with Trump and Vice President Mike Pence's blessing. They've proposed a budget that takes a meat cleaver to public education and programs that work for kids and families. After-school and summer programs, gone. Funding for community schools that provide social, emotional, health, and academic programs to kids, gone. Investments to keep class sizes low and provide teachers with the training and support they need to improve their craft, gone. Their budget cuts financial aid for low-income college students grappling with student debt at the same time the Trump administration is making it easier for private loan servicers to prey on students and families. The Trump-DeVos budget funnels more than $1 billion to new voucher and market strategies, even though study after study concludes those strategies have hurt kids. Recent studies of voucher programs in Ohio and Washington, D.C. show students in these programs did worse than those in traditional public schools. Further, private voucher schools take money away from neighborhood public schools, lack the same accountability that public schools have, fail to protect kids from discrimination, and increase segregation. It's dangerous in education when the facts don't matter to people. But it doesn't stop there. Schools must be safe and welcoming places for all children, and that's a belief shared by both parents who send their kids to voucher schools and those who send their kids to public schools. But Trump and DeVos have acted to undermine the rights of kids who look or feel different and to cut funding for school health and safety programs. What Trump and DeVos are doing stands in stark contrast to the bipartisan consensus we reached in 2015 when Congress passed a new education law that shifted the focus from testing back to teaching, pushed decision-making back to states and communities, and continued to invest funds in the schools that need it the most. It offered an opportunity to focus on what we know works best for kids and schools, promoting children's well-being, engaging in powerful learning, building teacher capacity, and fostering cultures of collaboration. The Trump-DeVos agenda not only jeopardizes that work, their view that education is a commodity as opposed to a public good threatens the foundation of our democracy and our responsibility to provide opportunity to all of America's young people. Americans have a deep connection to and belief in public education. I see it every day as I crisscross the nation talking to parents, teachers, students, and community members about what they want for their public schools. And it transcends politics. It's one of the reasons we saw such a massive grassroots response to the DeVos nomination from every part of the country. A recent poll by Harvard and Politico showed that while parents want good public school choices to meet the individual needs of their kids, they do not want those choices pit against one another or used to drain money from other public schools. In other words, the DeVos-Trump agenda is wildly out of step with what Americans want for their kids. It's what I saw when I took DeVos to visit public schools in Van Wert, Ohio last month. This is an area that voted more than 70% for Trump, But people there love and invest in their public schools, from a strong early childhood program to robust robotics and other strategies that engage kids in powerful learning, to a community school that helps the kids most at risk of dropping out stay on a path to graduation. It's what I saw at the Community Health Academy of the Heights in New York City, where the school provides a full-service community health clinic, in-school social workers, a food pantry, parent resource center, and other services for parents and kids. And it's what I saw this week at Rock Island Elementary School in Broward County, Florida, where kids participate in robotics programs after school, where there is a library in every classroom and a guided reading room where kids can build their literacy skills. The great things happening in these schools are all funded by federal dollars and threatened by the Trump-DeVos budget. Many of those who voted for Trump did so because they believed he would keep his promise to stand up for working people and create jobs. They didn't vote to dismantle public education and with it the promise and potential it offers their children. Now, the person who ran on jobs and the economy seems intent on crushing one of the most important institutions we have to meet the demands of a changing economy, enable opportunity, and propel our nation forward. That's one of the biggest takeaways from Trump's first 100 days. You can't bomb Ebola, How Nations Should Respond to the Next Pandemic, by Alexandra Sifferlin. The Ebola outbreak of 2014 infected more than 28,000 people in West Africa and killed more than 11,000. It also exposed gaps in the world's ability to respond to epidemics of infectious diseases. Are we more prepared now to respond to future emerging disease outbreaks? Experts say countries are better positioned, but there's still a lot of room for improvement. Ours is not a culture of outbreak prevention, said Dr. Nahid Badilia, medical director of the Special Pathogen Unit at the Boston University School of Medicine, during a panel at Fortune's Brainstorm Health Conference on Wednesday. Badilia worked as an Ebola treatment unit clinician on four different trips to West Africa during the outbreak. We chase one pathogen after another, he said. It's critical for countries to find innovative ways to prevent another pandemic, experts said. Tapping into community resources is one crucial approach, said Dr. Raj Panjabi, the CEO of Last Mile Health, who trained 1,300 community health workers through his organization to offer care and workout logistics during the Ebola outbreak. Panjabi, who recently received the $1 million TED Prize, is now launching Community Health Academy, the largest group of community health workers in the world. By training community members to become healthcare workers for their neighborhoods, countries like Liberia were better able to respond to Ebola. The same will be true of future health crises, he says. Getting organized on a local level is also necessary for an adequate response. At the start of the Ebola outbreak, most health workers in Liberia were working as volunteers, Panjabi said. Now the country has approved policies to train, equip, and pay community health workers. However, more support is needed to make sure nations are well prepared. There's not enough investment in these settings, said Panjabi. Ebola spread like wildfire across West Africa. Companies shut down. Airlines started cutting their routes to West Africa. There are real consequences in not investing in the idea of health care for everyone, everywhere. As for the best approach for the United States to take, the experts at the panel argue that leaders should not forget the lessons learned from the outbreak. One of the places we would really hurt ourselves would be to ignore the signals we've learned from Ebola, said Panjabi. You can't bomb Ebola or put up a wall to stop Ebola. 30% of malls will shut down during the next recession, real estate expert says, by Sarah Begley. As e-commerce has boomed in recent years, traditional retailers have taken a hit.
Last month, the New York Times reported that 89,000 Americans employed in general merchandise stores had lost their jobs since October. And when the next recession inevitably hits, things are going to get even worse for retailers. Christopher Leinberger, chair of George Washington University's Center for Real Estate and Urban Analysis, tells NPR that the next recession will likely cause 30% of malls to shutter. Both regional malls and strip malls will be impacted, and those in the middle of the market will be hit the hardest. The previous big transformation of retail was from walkable urban in the early 20th century, you know, the main streets, to regional malls, he says. Well, we're going back now to the 21st century version of Main Street. Increasingly, Leinberger predicts the retail winners will be stores like Bonobos or Warby Parker, which serve more as showrooms than warehouses for customers to go and try on merchandise before ordering online. This is how the experience economy manifests itself in this new walkable urban world, which is the future of our metropolitan growth in this country, he says. And it's going to be very economically productive. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.